Welcome to the Dooldig Studios, Creative Women in Conversation. The Dooldig Studio is a not-for-profit house museum with a gallery and sculpture garden. It is the former home of Slava Horovitz Dooldig and her husband, sculptor Carl Dooldig. The Dooldig Studio holds a nationally significant collection of sculptures, artworks, furniture and archives, which tell the story of this emigre family's journey from Europe via Switzerland and Singapore to Australia. The Dooldig Studio aims to inspire creative journeys through the telling of this story and through its public and education programs. This series of talks is inspired by Slava's inventiveness and interests. Our two creative women in conversation will explore influences, ideas and stories in the creative process. So, welcome to Creative Women in Conversation number one. This week we'll be talking about fashion and style, and our speakers are Susan DeMarcy and Jamie Clissaris. At the age of 20, Jamie Clissaris became Stonington's youngest councillor and the youngest female councillor elected in the 2012 Victorian local government elections. In November 2016, Jamie became Stonington's youngest mayor at the age of 24. She was the youngest female mayor in Victoria. Jamie sits on Stonington's Community Service Advisory Committee, the Economic Development and Culture Committee, and the Finance Committee. She served as a board member for the Paran Mission from November 2012 to March 2015 and was elected to the MAV board representing the Metro South East region in March 2017 for a two-year term. And Susan DeMarcy, award-winning designer and artisan, Susan DeMarcy is the creative director of fashion house Material Byproduct. She established the brand in Melbourne in 2003 and has consistently delivered collections described by fashion commentators as a seamless blend of fashion and art. Since 2004, the Melbourne-based designer has quietly made a name for herself creating esoteric garments that unpack the process of their own construction. The dashes and dots of a tailor's marking system employed as a decorative motif, external bias-bound seams that look like piping and speak to the old sewing class rule that a garment should look just as good on the inside as it does right way out. The material byproduct manufacturing process remains breathtakingly meticulous, but now DeMarcy's focus is more human. She's no longer making clothes about clothes, she's making them for a coterie of well-to-do professional women who want to be as comfortable and presentable as possible. A typical material byproduct dress is made from bias-cut silk. It skims the body fluidly. You ask for a trend forecaster about the direction luxury is moving towards bespoke and local would sit high on the list of buzzwords. If a few years from now, material byproduct clothes made locally wind up being shown for pure pleasure in a little chamber perched above the Strand in London for an eager audience of silks, then DeMarcy will have established a legacy entirely her own. Welcome, Susan and Jamie.
Thank you for those lovely introductions. As has already been said, I'm Councillor Jamie Clissaris, Mayor of Stonington, and it's my absolute pleasure to be here today. I'd just like to acknowledge that we are meeting on the land of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri people and offer our respects to their elders past and present. Thank you for coming along to help us kick off the Creative Women in Conversation series. This fantastic series is a way to celebrate what's happening in art and design for women in Australia and gives us the opportunity to reflect on the legacy and importance of women in the arts. Today's conversation focuses on the theme of fashion and style. Stonington is renowned for its vibrant fashion precincts and strong arts and cultural activity, so I'm thrilled to be here to support this event, which highlights leading creative practitioners and, of course, local businesswomen. I'm honoured to be speaking with award-winning designer and artisan Susan from fashion house Material Byproduct. Since its launch in 2003, Material Byproduct has consistently delivered collections described by fashion commentators as a seamless blend of fashion and art. Susan's excellence has seen her collaborate with avant-garde artists such as Bjork, show at Milan Fashion Week, and work with leading fashion houses including Lanvin and Ferragamo. And here we are, of course, in the beautiful Dooldig Studio. This not-for-profit house museum and sculpture garden is a publicly available heritage place and displays the works of artists and innovators Carl and Slava Dooldig. On the second Saturday of every month until May next year, leaders in creative practice and business will explore themes such as fashion, sculpture, and textile and furniture design during the series. These talks and the exhibition offer the opportunity to consider, reflect on, and inform what's happening in art and design for women in Australia then and now. The City of Stonington is proud to support this program through the cultural grant to support innovative arts programming and showcasing the visual arts, contemporary women artists and designers, local organisations, and leading and emerging business women. So thank you, and I hope you enjoy today's conversation. We'll go straight into it. Now, I think it is going to be more of a conversation and we would love to involve you. So if you have any questions or thoughts along the way, just jump in. So I think we'll sort of try and start at the beginning a little bit. So when, Susan, when did you know that you wanted to be a designer and why fashion design?
I switched on to fashion design when I was about 14 years old. Until then, I wanted to be a painter. My auntie, also an immigrant to Australia, an Italian immigrant, was a painter, so I spent a lot of time around her ankles and around her easel, looking at her and looking at what she did, and she was an exemplary woman in our community, in our family, and she ran a studio out of her house in Mildura, country town, Victoria, where she had to overcome prejudice and became a leading figure in the community, and a lot of tourists would go to her house to see her work. And then when I was about 14, Country Town Victoria, ABC television, sitting in the family room, pre-internet, saw a documentary on Coco Chanel. Whole family watched it and I just thought, oh my God, who is this woman? She's living in 1920s Paris. She didn't get married. She didn't have children. She hung out with all these amazing artists and she created this amazing thing called a fashion house. And she was the first woman to put her name on a perfume. And that name continues to define the template for 20th century dressing. And that's when I got switched on to the notion of being a fashion designer, because it brought together my love of art and the idea of being a painter or a sculptor or doing all of those things with, I guess, a culturally ingrained living, being brought up in an Italian family, sense of getting dressed.
So I understand that you mainly work with silk, wool and leather. Why those fabrics? What makes them special and great to work with?
I jokingly refer to myself as an old man tailor in a young woman's body. And as I stroke a piece of masking tape that's on my little finger, because I was teaching one of the girls how to stitch by hand this morning, those fabrics, if anyone that's familiar or not familiar with textiles, those fabrics are all from the protein family. So they're all from an animal or an insect. And they're just such great fabrics to tailor with. And the art of tailoring, I mean, often when we think of tailoring, we think of a men's suit, but essentially the art of tailoring is cutting cloth and rejoining it, and a series of steaming and presses along the way that sculpt an outcome. And tailoring is a concept that entered the European vocabulary around the 13th century. The Latin definition of the word tailoring literally is to cut. So you're coming out of drapery in antiquity, and then the Middle Ages, which was a bit of a sort of mix of drapery and things starting to be cut, and then you're going into a boom in textiles in an empire then, which is modern day France, called Burgundy, and these people called tailors started to cut cloth up and shape fashion shapes that were more specifically men and women. So historically your tailoring cloths have always been wool and silk, and for a reason, because they just sculpt beautifully. And in a contemporary context, for me, they are, and this is controversial, they are really sustainable cloths. And what I mean by sustainable is they wear incredibly well. So they wear on our body really well. They don't, for like practical purposes, get smelly and need to be laundered all the time like polyesters do. They wear really well on our body in terms of they feel fabulous to wear. They wear really well. They age beautifully. Even I'm a big advocate of wearing silk every day. You know, pick the right silks, and they just wear on your body really well. We often think of silk as special, but it's actually just a very beautiful cloth and fibre to wear every day. And I'm wearing silk and wool. And the ageing side of it is where I think there's particular... the way those things age, and to create clothes that you want to wear in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time, and maybe 15 years' time, and maybe 20 years' time, and might have a life after you've finished with it. Not sustainable in terms of ticking boxes of sustainability, of how much water was used in the consumption, etc. That's a different side of sustainability. But for me as a craftsperson and practicing my craft, tailoring, most sustainable fabrics, I think, are really hard to improve on.
So where does your inspiration come from in terms of the images that you actually create with these fabrics and the colours you use and all of that?
My inspiration is always actually from the cloth itself and cutting. And it's such an unremarkable answer in terms of the sort of, I guess, the stereotype of fashion designer. And we see it on television all the time. It's, you know, flick of the wrist on a piece of paper. It's sort of spinning a mannequin around. And it's so not what I do. I think what I do is much more relatable to being maybe an engineer or a draftsperson. I really love to be at my cutting table with a piece of cloth in front of me and a pair of scissors in my hands. And I will find a way through that cloth that creates the next form. So it's not dissimilar to having your hands on a block of clay. And not necessarily starting out with a picture on the wall of I'm going to make this shaped vase, but letting that come out of the block of clay. Or sitting in front of a blank canvas and not necessarily saying this is the photograph I'm going to repaint. And so for me, being an artisan, so we do make everything in our atelier, and I do go through the discipline and repetition of cutting the same dress again and again and again. And it's through that practice and that repetition that the next idea, the next opportunity is shown to me.
So given all of that, what kind of women are you dressing? Who is your main clientele?
I dress professional women who are defining the 21st century. So I don't make red carpet and I don't make bridal. And if I do either of those things, it usually comes from an established patron who I've dressed. It's a special request, and the request usually comes in a hurried text message or an email like, Susan, can you just take care of this for me? That's one less thing for me to think about. So that says a lot about the sort of woman that I might do red carpet or bridal for. They're hell busy. They're professional. Probably getting dressed 6 a.m. in the morning, and they have to be in that whatever they get dressed at 6 a.m. in the morning. They'll be in it till minimum 6 p.m. at night, and then they might be at a networking function, or they might be at a charity or philanthropic function in the evening, and they get dressed once, and they're just, you know, they might be going from school drop-off to board meeting to sitting at their desk and doing some work to being in front of clients to at a board meeting to then being networking or family social at night. So hell busy women who get dressed at 6 a.m. in the morning with their eyes closed, and they function at a very high level all day making decisions, and they know their tastes. They are usually come from a house where there has been dressmaking, or have gone to tailors, or have done textiles, and they have done tried dressmaking themselves. And so they have an appreciation of beautiful fabrics. I don't have to educate them on the difference between silk and polyester. They know that. You know, as one of my board members, if I ever saw a dress that's not in silk, she says, can I have it in silk? And I say, of course you can, it'll be double the price. She says, that's fine, because she just knows that silk works for her always. She doesn't like the feel of anything else on her body. Professional women defining the 21st century, but they know what their tastes are and what works for them. But they also, like all good professional women, they know when to take good advice as well.
So to
where do you source your fabrics? Do you travel to Europe or to China?
I've done all of the above, or to Europe, not to China. All silk still comes out of Asia in one way or another. So, look, I work with a diversity of suppliers. Essentially, I'm 15 years into practice, so what I'm trying to do to deliver better and better and better outcomes to my clients. And trying means it's like a constant work in progress. Go direct to mill and source, or direct to the actual farmer and grower. So I'm trying to migrate all of my supply chain, to talk in technicalities, away from wholesale to direct to mill and direct to grower. And for several reasons, ultimately to give the client the best outcome. And what that means is a variety of things. Stable quality, things that are made to my specification, and also to support what I think is the way of the future. So if I could get a fibre or a yarn that is ethically and sustainably produced, I will. And that will mean several things. How is the animal treated? How is the environment treated? How is it dyed? How is it manufactured? And because I do like silk wool leather, they're all kind of actually becoming endangered species, the other side of the ecological coin. So if I can go direct to suppliers and manufacturers that are innovating that space, I will. It's challenging, but I will. Yeah.
So I notice you brought some pieces today. Can you maybe hold one up or just talk about this particular piece and
sure.
What is it, first of all?
These are a series of scarves we do. They're called word scarves, and
it's gorgeous.
So
wow. And that's a silk.
That's a heavy silk crepe. Yep. These are finished in our studio, but they're a photographic process, which is then digitally printed in the Netherlands. And these are, they're called word scarves because they've all got words on them, and they've got a bit of a cult status. They're produced in limited editions, this year a limited edition of 8. And they, a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek, playful, behind-the-scenes look at what we do. So you may notice on what I'm wearing, we have these beautiful silk-bound seams, and I'll throw Laura under the bus. She's as an example. And so when people walk into our atelier or our tailoring workshop, they'll see this sort of work in progress, this sort of painstaking work of creating these silk-bound seams and finishing them. So they might walk past the hand-finishing table where they'll see the girls working these binds into ends. And then they get the finished pieces into their wardrobe. What the word scarves do is take that sort of snapshot behind the scene that people get when they walk into the functional workroom and capture it in a scarf. So one of the things that all the women love who come into our atelier, as I mentioned, they've probably come from a house where there's been dressmaking. They love looking at fabrics. You know, so first thing they see when they walk in is a wall full of fabrics. And they love to touch fabrics. They'll be very specific about fabrics. And if they don't have that, I'm seeing a very very positive trend in a younger client that maybe didn't get the domestic science at home or school. They want it. They know they've missed out on it. They know there's a missing link of knowledge, and they want to know what is the difference between silk and polyester, and they want to be able to talk about it knowledgeably the same way as the barrister wants to sit at a dinner table and talk knowledgeably about their wine. They want to sit and talk knowledgeably about why their thing is pure silk, not something else. This is a bit of a sneak peek into a collaboration with Yering Station. They'll launch a limited edition sparkling, 100 bottles of limited edition sparkling next month or month after, with the artisan label on it.
Fantastic. So to connect to the space that we're in today, Slava made her invention, being one of the world's first foldable umbrellas, which you'll all have to look at in the case behind me after. It's fascinating. It was at a time when women were not commonly seen as inventors. Have you faced any barriers in your career over the last 14, 15 years as an artist and designer? And do you think any of that is attributed to the fact that you are a woman?
The answer is yes and no. The no answer is, you know, I'm a privileged white woman in a country where I'm free. And also my mother was an Italian immigrant, and she was courageous enough just to say, I was an immigrant, and she immigrated when she was a young child, and she immigrated with a family that maintained the traditions, and she got married young and had a family and was a farmer's wife. And she said, I didn't have choices so just go and do whatever you want. You know, just do well. She used to actually literally say, because I grew up on a vineyard in Mildura, and she used to literally say, look, do well at school and you can go to uni and you can do whatever you want. Don't do well at school and here's the farm and you'll become a farmer's wife. So that was a pretty good motivator for me, because I was a dreamer. I was a dreamer. I was head in books and art books and looking at women. I didn't know who Slava was, but, you know, I was looking at these sorts of women who have these amazing lives. I was like, that's the sort of life I want to have. I want to go to uni and I want to study fine art before I got switched on to fashion. And I want to have this sort of amazing, adventurous life full of beautiful things and making beautiful things. So on that... In that capacity, lucky and no barriers given to me by my family or my immediate culture. Then, you know, I went to uni and I was working with different set of ideas and progressed right through the level of a PhD that I hadn't finished, have not finished. And I was creating these ideas of systems, you know, to do what I do now in 21st century Australia, which is an incredibly high labour cost country, which everyone said, you can't do what you want to do, it's not here. And so to do it, I worked on this idea of creating systems, so taking traditional tailoring systems and translating them into something that was relevant, systematic, scalable, that preserved artisan but also brought it into contemporary context for our economy, our geographic position, and also gave a new generation of women tailoring, the experience of tailoring. But then as I move in and out of the business world, and that was beautifully received, you know, really from the start, from other artists and clients, that was beautifully received. As my profile grew in the business world, I've often encountered in a business scenario people saying, men typically would say to me, oh, but your business can't be scaled because it's you, which relates really to this idea of, is something able to be patented, is something being able to be scaled, and something able to be expanded as a business. And my response now used to just kind of hit me and make me a little bit sort of breathless. But now when I have somebody say that to me, I say, have you ever heard of Xenia or Prada or Armani? Chanel? Because they all started with one person who it was their DNA, which has been captured you know, but started with one person and one person's singular vision, which then became what we call a brand DNA. But I think we're so obsessed with brands now that we actually forget to step back to that brand was a person who had a way of doing something that was different to everybody else, had something to offer, that then became systemized into a way of production and doing business. And
so do you think you would have had that response to your ideas if it had been a man pitching those ideas?
I think if maybe I was talking about like creating a car or something, it might have been better received. But where there's still an overarching idea that fashion is a sort of ephemeral thing, you know. And then often if I engage in that conversation, I'll say, let's just take a few steps back. The Industrial Revolution started with the industrialization of cloth production. It didn't start with the production of cars. Yes, Henry Ford is a big example of manufacturing, but the Industrial Revolution actually started with cloth manufacturing, and then went from cloth manufacturing into the, you know, the creation of uniforms and pajamas and things that were, you know, a fast-moving consumer goods in the fashion space. And fashion is also its own worst enemy at creating that overarching sense of it's just this kind of ephemeral, fleeting thing that is whimsy and trend. And yeah, there's aspects of that in fashion. Some aspects are really vital, and poetry and beauty should always be present. But then it doesn't tend to translate in the Australian context into an understanding that there is a serious industry and a serious technical industry that underpins that. France and Italy know there's a serious industry that underpins fashion.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you see, over the last 10, 20, 30 odd years, how do you see the changes in the fashion market, how we buy clothes, how we choose things, and just how do you, what are the changes that you've seen?
Just to talk about my own experience, because it's the one that I can talk about with authority, may not necessarily be everybody else's experience. Certainly, I'm only here 14 years later because I've changed a lot in 14, 15 years. So, you know, I started with the same starry-eyed romance of going to Europe and, you know, going to Paris and Milan every season and showing my work there and talking to international buyers. And to a certain extent, I had some dumb luck in terms of actually an important Milanese buyer was in Melbourne, came for a fashion week, which I wasn't even a part of, didn't buy anything. Somebody told him about me. We met and he bought my work, and that essentially was the start of my fashion house. I was working as a curator at National Gallery of Victoria at the time and an academic at RMIT, and that sort of just kicked off the start of my house. And then I knew he wouldn't come back, so I started to travel to Italy and Paris and sell my work, and my work was selling in Italy and Paris. But fashion is a very expensive game to play. The business of playing the fashion game is, it's kind of like being at the high rollers table. Unless you've got a lot of money in your back pocket, particularly when you're traversing geographies from Australia to Europe, you know, just one number, you know, if you're starting where I started from in London, a trip to Paris is going to cost you £200. Doing it from Australia, it's going to cost you £2,000 each throw. So it's an expensive game to play. So even though I was picking up accounts and high-profile accounts and picked up a commission from international pop star York and, you know, was in the right magazines and things like that, I just simply didn't have the cash in my back pocket to sustain playing that game. So then I had to get serious about doing business. And when you're playing that game as a young designer, you're playing on the high-rolling stakes that a bigger company is going to pick you up and turn you into a big star. And that's sort of how the game is played, and that's where people like Gareth Pugh come from, or now we've got the Demir Domars and people who are the young rock stars or Infant Terribles of fashion now. Is that sort of where you go, and you're either picked up by a bigger house and installed as a designer, or someone backs you, or both. It's one in a million that will happen to. And we were on that trajectory, but I had the tyranny of geography. I also then had a business partner that I could have picked up and relocated, but she had children and she couldn't. So we were here. And I remember when I withdrew from the European space, there was a sense of disappointment and like, oh, gee, I got this far. And I'd also been approached by Parisian House to design for Parisian House. And a sense of sort of frustration. In hindsight, it's kind of one of the best things that ever happened to me, because I built a real business that actually operates on cash flow with real clients. It's not a huge business. It's been jokingly referred to by the author of Fashion and Art in the 21st Century as Australia's best kept fashion secret, but it's a real business that actually makes real clothes for really amazing women who really wear them every day and operates on real cash flow. So it's actually been, to a certain extent, couldn't go as far and as fast as I wanted to, but I have something that's quite real and quite tangible and pays for itself and pays for me and pays for the people that work for me. So, oh, yes.
Do you put out a collection each year or... and have it shown in Melbourne?
That's a really good question. I've changed the way I've done that several times because it has been a series of changing. And just to quickly answer Jamie's question, so I went from the Paris circuit, I went from doing wholesale, and I went from doing wholesale at a time when online was coming in. I figured out that wholesale was going to send me broke, and then I started to just focus on these amazing women that were knocking on my door going, we've heard about you, can we buy directly from you? And I did my sums and went, why would I do wholesale, which is going to send me broke? If I can deal directly with the end user who's going to pay me 100% up front, I'm going to have a really nice time dealing with them. And so that's like just three examples of how my business changed. And at that time, I was also doing the two collections a year. Because I started in European circuit, I was doing European seasons. I still officially, till last month, do European seasons. However, I quickly got a reputation as being trans-seasonal. So it was being in Melbourne, the city of four seasons in one day. You know, being in Melbourne, doing European seasons, getting on and off aeroplanes, I developed a way of designing collections that were basically trans-seasonal. So whether you're buying into spring, summer or autumn, winter, you'll basically wear one of my pieces for 70% of the year. There'll be probably three months of the year where it gets some downtime, but you'll basically be wearing pieces for 70 to 80% of the year because of the fabrics, the silk wool leather, because of the way I designed the pieces to go together, whether it's from the same collection or previous, and my tailoring. As of last month, I declared in my newsletter, no more seasons. No more seasons. It's a false construct. And I came to that decision that there was no more seasons because I have this face-to-face engagement with every single woman that wears my pieces. And seasons are not relevant to her. When she comes through the door, I'm about what you need. What do you need? So a lot of my established clients will often ask me to remake something they've already got because they like this dress. It's amazing. You know, I had a barrister recently come in. She goes, that dress, I was in hell trial last week. That dress just saved me. I just didn't have to think about it. I just put it on under robes. Please make me two more. Okay? You know, and it doesn't smell. It doesn't crease. I can sit in it for 20 hours a day. I'm comfortable, but then I like what I'm wearing too. So there's that sort of feedback. Oftentimes a new person will come through the studio, and if I'm selling them a wardrobe, like a solution, which could be three pieces or four pieces or more, I don't go to one season. I'll listen to them and look at them and I'll go and say, I think you need these pieces. And that might be, some of them will go back up to 10 years. And that's also the beauty of running an atelier, is it doesn't matter. I can make that piece from 10 years ago. And what I'm really dedicated to is not giving them a look, but giving them a solution and really creating a wardrobe for them, whether it's one piece at a time or whether it's four pieces and then topping up two or three pieces at a time, that they're going to get that wardrobe that they look back at and go, I've been wearing those things for 10 years. And I still wear them, and I still wear them on high rotation, and I still get compliments on them. And if I need them refreshed, revived, altered, I bring them back to you, and you're going to do that for me. Yeah. So, yeah, last season, I had a whole spring, summer ready to go, and I said, I'm not doing any more seasons. Cut. It's 3 to 5 pieces a month. Some of them are revised pieces. Some of them are brand new pieces that continue the tradition of what I do. And so I mix it up, and I can work real time with what I'm hearing, seeing and smelling.
Do you have a design process? Do you sketch or do you...
I cut. Yeah, I cut. I cut and construct, yeah. So our process is called, summarised as the mark, the cut, the join. They're the three core steps of tailoring. You mark cloth, you cut it and then you rejoin it. We have three signature ways we do it. The marking is a little bit obtuse for me to explain, but the join, you can see the silk-bound seams, the hand-stitched seams, which create a strong line. The cut is, I try and create a cut that is very minimal. I call it very minimal with a very maximum outcome. So sometimes a dress might look, or a coat might look quite sophisticated. It might be three cuts that gets there. Yeah, and then I engage a team in that.
So, given that you blend art and fashion in such an amazing way, would you say that that's quite a unique thing that you do within the fashion industry? Is there a reemergence of doing this within fashion design, or you're not really seeing it elsewhere very much?
For me, it's natural. Mm. Yeah, for me, it's really natural. I wouldn't like to comment on the whole of the fashion industry. I think, for me, it's natural for the women that come to my atelier. It's natural. I mean, typically, an engagement with someone that comes into the atelier is... it's all by private appointment. I will send a car to collect clients when they need it. A lot of time they're like, oh, just let me walk and get some fresh air because they've been at the desk too much, too often, for too long. And they'll come in and sit down and we'll have a conversation. Very rarely are clothes tried on. So it's quite old-fashioned like that. And I don't know, how many women here like trying on clothes? So, same. They don't want to try anything on. Often the first time they'll try things on is in a fitting. And if it's an established client, we'll cut to the chase and by text message I'll be like, these are the pieces I think you might need. And the first time they come in to see me, it's actually for the fitting. And then in the conversation, we'll talk about art. So Dior's topical at the moment. What do you think? Have you been? Do you like what Maria Grazia Touri is doing for the label? Even, you know, these will be not fashion women. I mean, there's some women at like RBA board level or, you know, in law practice or busy running their own business. And I'll turn around and say to me, Sis, what do you think of this guy at Balenciaga now? And I just think, how do you even know who he is? Like, where did you get the time to be across that? Like, you know, like, surprising, just really surprising. And so our conversations will always blend art, fashion, current affairs, what's happening in business now. You know, when a member of the RBA board asks you how business is, that's a very pointed question. And I tell her exactly how business is. I tell her exactly what's going on in business with no veils or because she's making decisions about the economy of our country. So I will tell her exactly how business is and why I'm making certain decisions. So for us, for my tribe, and I think that is something indicative about contemporary fashion, is the big houses are getting, you know, mega brands. Chanel is a mega brand now. Vuitton is a mega brand now. You're going to have those mega brands, and then the middle market's kind of been wiped out. And so you've got Zara's and HMs and other such like Uniqlo, basically kind of wiped out any manufacturers in the middle market because they can do it faster and cheaper. And they can also co-opt from the big brands very quickly. So if big brand does XYZ that connects to art or design, they can copy it very quickly. And then you're going to have this layer, which is, I think, very diverse, whether it's what I do or something really at the other end of the spectrum, like someone that just does denim, just does Japanese denim, that's all they do. But it's very specific vision, and they'll have their tribe, and their tribe will have their common interests. And so my tribe is professional women and artists and designers. And what links the professional women and the artists and designers is the professional women probably wanted to be Slava, probably wanted to be artist designers, and they figured out they weren't any good at it or that they were better in other places, so they probably have an art collection and they probably cross over in their philanthropic interests in art and design. So that's my tribe. And so for us to bring all of those things together is normal.
And where does the name Material Byproduct come from? Is there a story behind that?
It comes from an exhibition I did before I officially launched as in a house, and it was a somewhat cynical exhibition commenting on the nature of disposable fashion and the accelerating cycle of disposable fashion. And I slightly changed the name from the exhibition to what's used now. And that exhibition work was the work that was bought by the Milanese buyer, which says something about the Milanese, because he literally bought just the exhibition and put it in his shop and sold it. And now it just says that the byproduct, the dress, the scarf, it is the byproduct of the process, the tailoring process.
Fantastic. Are there any other questions or thoughts floating around?
You've spoken a lot about all the good things and all the things you've come to. Have you ever had to compromise nitty-gritty compromise your integrity, or have you had the client from hell who wanted to do something, or a piece of fabric that fought with you that didn't, Some of it all sounds so wonderful,
and
they've all just fallen into place.
They're
your turning points.
Oh, well, I'm glad it sounds wonderful. It's been a hell of a lot of hard work. It
sounds too easy.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, being here is my pleasurable part of Saturday. I clocked into the studio at 9:30 this morning with two girls who are still stitching. So every time I've compromised at the level of integrity, I've regretted it and then I've corrected. But on other levels of humanity, it's always a compromise. So to give you an example of compromising on the level of integrity, when I was still dealing with wholesalers, and at one point I had a list of 16 wholesalers that I was selling to, you know, they all wanted, this was about 10 years, everyone wanted a $300 dress. Now, you can't make a $300 dress in Australia. You just can't. You can't make a $300 dress and good fabric and good construction in Australia. Not that I know how to do it anyway. I cannot make a $300 dress. If I was to try and make a $300 dress, I would have to go to China and, you know, get 100 units made and make compromises on the fabric and the finish and everything like that. But when I was getting this constant request for the $300 dress, the $400 dress, the dress under $500, I, for example, tried to use a viscose jersey. Now, not a wool, not a cotton, not a silk. I love jerseys. Wool, jersey, silk jersey. Now, a wholesale price of the most basic, the wholesale price of the most basic wool jersey I use, I'm wearing two Australian jerseys today, Charles Parsons Merino. This is a Ponte, this is midweight. $26 a metre is the wholesale price. And I'm buying it at the top price because I'm not buying 100 or 200 metres at a time, I'm buying 20 metres at a time. So the retail price of that is going to be almost $60, right? So you start to do your sums. If your wholesale price, that's no labour, that's just the fabric, you know? That's no hand stitching, that's no cutting. Now, the price of labour, roughly, is $25 an hour. So then put your labour in, and then we live in a high governance state. So before you even open the doors, add another 30% on top. How do you get a $300 dress out? So then I did try using fabrics which were like $4 a metre. So your average garment that's in the Uniqlo level or something like that, your average price point of your wholesale fabric is going to be $4 a metre or less. Or less. A bra in... I had a conversation with somebody about... Somebody who worked for Pack Brands... So Pack Brands is your Bonds and etc. You know, a trim, if you're working at Pack Brands, can't be more than 50 cents a metre. Can't be more. That's the top price it can be paid for. So, you know, so I bought fabric at $4 a metre. And of course, and then I put beautiful construction on it. Stupid. Stupid. Because the fabric just falls out of the beautiful construction. And then, of course, the clients would come back and say, you know, this is peeling. Well, this didn't wash well. And so that just would then compromise my integrity. Now, they're happy to buy it at $300 or $400, but you're just not going to get the quality of a $1,000 dress. And even myself, you know, I've got pieces that I've got a silk, little silk jersey tunic that I literally made, same generation as what you've got, Laura, 2007. It's a little silk. Now, silk jersey runs at $60 a metre wholesale. And it's becoming rarer and rarer to get. Rarer and rarer and rarer. And every time you go back to buy silk, the prices have gone up because Chinese kids don't want to feed silkworms anymore. Fancy that. They want to play video games. But I've got a little silk jersey tunic that I came out in 2007. And I literally wear it as a nightie. I wear it all year round. And I just wash it in the shower. Old travelers have it. Just wash it in the shower, hang it on a hanger, and it still is going 10 years later. Still looks fine. I could wear it out on the street. Last year, I with the same supplier that does these, I wanted to get some silk jersey printed, and they said we're not doing the silk jersey anymore. Here's the rayon. Okay. And I was really disappointed because they're actually really good suppliers and have fabulous fabrics. And I thought, why aren't you doing it anymore? You know, you guys, I come to you for great fabrics. Anyway, I had a go at the rayon and I took a similar piece to this little tunic home in November of last year to wear it as a new updated nightdress. I don't even have it anymore. I don't even have it. Within weeks, it had sprung holes, it had bagged, it had gaped. And I took photos of it and I sent it back to the supplier and said, hey guys, you've got to run the silk jersey again because I've only worn this months. So it's the same construction and it's falling apart. You know, the other one I've had for 10 years. So, yeah, whenever I've been compromised on those fundamentals, I've regretted it and I've corrected and now I won't. Compromise, on the other hand, I mean, I have a fabulous client base, but I have a fabulous client base because I handpick them. They don't just pick me, I pick them. There's a reason why I focus on professional women. They dress for themselves. They're not competing with their girlfriends. And they are intelligent and I can talk to them like an equal professional and they respect my opinion. And typically they will say, Susan, you know, I'll say, oh, it'll approximately be arrive at November 30 approximately and I'll get in touch with you for fitting. And I, whenever, we know it takes time. I did have a barrister place an order for three or four dresses late last month, very late in August. And she said, can you have them ready for me by the 20th of September? I'm going on holiday. I'd like to take them with me. And I said, look, it's a push, but I'll have it done. And then she just rang me out of the blue last Sunday. I was literally in the car on the way to the airport. She goes, you know, I woke up this morning and it's not necessary to have those dresses by the 20th of September. Just if you can have them done, have them done. I said, well, look, this is how it's tracking. It's not a problem to get these ones done, but if I could have more time on those two, particularly because we've changed the brief a little bit since you placed the order, I'd love it. So that's why I handpick the audience. And that handpicking process takes a lot of time, and it's taken also a little bit of, you know, it's taken 15 years of skilling up to just actually, like, even before I came here, I was on the phone with people. I said, look, I pick you as much as you pick me, and I just want to take 15 minutes to figure out whether we can help each other and work together, because I might not be for you, or you might not be for me.
Any other questions? I think on that. Oh yes.
Where did you learn your tailoring skills?
Lots of places, and I'm still learning them. I think with something like tailoring, like being an artist, designer, sculptor, you actually really don't stop learning. So this morning I was briefing a young girl in my studio, and sitting opposite the table was a girl that used to work for me, has come back to help me with some backlog. And I, both RMIT grads, and I'm an RMIT grad, so that's partly where I learned. I learned to answer the quick question. I learned at RMIT, I learned at home. After RMIT, I sought out old tailors in the industry that just nagged them to teach me, paid, and spent an enormous amount of time just on my own, trying stuff. I spent a lot of time in luxury retail before I started my own studio, turning garments inside out, unpicking them in my mind, reading fabric compositions, seeing who bought what, who. So very mixed and varied answered. Worked at NGV, was lucky enough to work as an assistant in international fashion and textiles, where I spent a lot of time in the collection, cataloguing. The joke used to be when I came up from cataloguing, did you count every stitch, Susan? and apparently there's still catalog sheets over 10 years later that I wrote that haven't actually gone through the system, I'm told. So a lot of places, and I think that's modern times where you have to kind of patchwork things together. But like an artist, I always just knew I had to commit to practicing my practice, and it's very much something I'm trying to teach a new generation, whether I go to RMIT to teach or whether I'm teaching my studio, is you don't just get this. There's no way of fast-tracking it. I don't know with AI in the future whether there'd be any way of fast-tracking it, but you only get this by doing it day in, day out, and day. And part of that is incredibly tedious. Like if you're a concert pianist and you have to go into the studio every day at a certain time and practice that piece, and practice that piece, and practice that piece until you hate it, and then you love it again, and then you can do it. Yeah. So when I was talking to the new girl today and the old girl that used to work for me, who's come back to help at the moment, I said, I don't even know how I taught you anything 5 years ago. Now I'm teaching. I know I'm teaching from a whole nother base of experience that I've had in the meantime. She goes, oh, you're a pretty good teacher. And I said, but I finished teaching in RMIT this semester, and I thought, oh, gee, I'm a bad teacher now. I think I've lost my patience. I think I'm over it. And then I went back into my studio and had to teach new staff, and I hadn't taught staff for a while because I had somebody who I trained teaching staff, and she was away on an extended break, and I started teaching new staff. And I realised I could teach in a way that I'd never taught my own staff before, only because of my 10 years of application since. But that's also very exciting because I think I don't see there being an end point to that learning and that skilling up, and then that obviously translates through my staff and through the outputs that we create.
Thank you for that. So I think on that note, I'd just like to thank you so much for coming to launch this series. I think we can draw a lot of parallels between Slava, your experiences. I'm sure we can all draw from Slava and Susan as well. So thank you so much. I invite you all to stay back and have a look at the exhibition and really get up close, because there are some really beautiful details and there's such an amazing story behind Slava and all these pieces if you don't already know it. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
So that's it for this week's Creative Women in Conversation. Thank you to our wonderful speakers. If anyone would like to know more about the Dooldig Studio, please go to our website at www.dooldig.org.au. Thank you all very much.